Good morning, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio, sign of land on the D-Day beaches of Normandy. And I don't have to go very far this time, just one time zone to Moscow, Russia with Tim Kirby. How are you doing, Tim?
Oh, very good, very good. I almost feel like your neighbor here. It is a short flight to where you are, so.
If only we could fly.
To be honest, it is nice because, yeah, usually with a lot of times, I've been giving a lot of interviews lately, which is a good thing, but it's always like the worst place is California. From California to here is, I think, like an exact 12-hour difference. Nothing ever lines up. Never.
Listen, a quick background. Tim and I, 8 months ago, before the special military operation in Ukraine, I don't remember how we got connected, but we did. We suggested a reciprocal interview. He interviewed me about China. I interviewed him about Russia. Both of them did really well on my website. I mean, tens of thousands of people watched them and listened together, the two of them together. And so now, special military operation, all hell is breaking loose. I contacted Tim. I said, hey, let's do another reciprocal. I just did one with him a couple of weeks ago about China. And now we're going to talk about Russia today. Everybody needs to subscribe like I do to Tim Kirby Russia. He's one of the few gringos out there in Russia who is actually doing honest to God reporting. I saw he had a video recently. He was on the Bering Strait in the very far eastern tip of Russia. He's doing incredible work. He's traveling around the country. It's really interesting, and I will add his YouTube channel to our interview page. So glad to have you back, Tim.
Well, it's my pleasure as always. What a wonderful, best intro of my life. Thank you very much. Already feeling good. So,
hey, listen, what is the evolving zeitgeist among average Russians about the current state of affairs in their country? I mean, we hear all kinds of, ridiculous propaganda in the West, but social, political, economic, infrastructure, buying power, cost of living, governance, et cetera. Just give us a thumbnail sketch about what the Russians are thinking and their lifestyle.
Well, I think that maybe there might be two phases to that. Well, maybe three. Let's go all the way back. When this the Maidan started in 2014, the Maidan Revolution, where they got rid of Yanukovych and replaced it with Poroshenko. Then Poroshenko was replaced by Zelensky. That whole process was, 8 years ago, and people kind of forget, especially in the Western media, that for 8 years, the people who live in the Donbass have been bombed, killed, tortured, and murdered over that time. So there was, over all those years, I would say the Russian public's sort of overall opinion was like, when are we going to do something about this? When are we going to stop this? Why aren't we doing more? When? I've made this point a million times in my videos, but it bears repeating. That, there were two events that made Putin's popularity rating drop by like 10%. One was the Social Security or pension reforms, whatever you want to call it. We're both Americans, so let's say Social Security reforms. And the other were the events of the Maidan, because people were just sort of sitting there, from their homes watching people just like them suffer. And that changed. So I would say that we went from that sort of mood of, what are we going to do about this? When are we going to do something about this? That was first mood. Then when the actual special operation started, I would say that it was definitely met with, we're getting what we want, And I think the population understood that there's going to be a price to pay for this, but we're going to pay it because it's the right thing to do. And now I think we're actually in a mood of what's going to be next. Like, the population sort of sees that it's just a sort of matter of time till this all grinds down anyways. What's next? Where are we going? What are things going to look like, especially from the standpoint of your job, or maybe more so your business? People don't know what to do. Should they buy a car? For example, when you have to sort of, you can only get car parts through semi-legal like Turkish dealers. Do you really want to buy like a BMW right now, even if you had the money? Maybe, maybe not. You know, or people are wondering, okay, well, should I buy a Russian car then? Because finally, the Russian cars are now 100% Russian made with Russian parts. But at the same time, well, what happens if all this goes back to the way it was in like a year? Well, then they'll feel like they wasted their money because they could have gotten the BMW. You see what I mean? So there's sort of a analysis of paralysis waiting is, I think, really what's sort of swept over the public right now.
What about the day-to-day life, inflation, food supply? You know, just, I mean, because over here in France, you know, we're suffering double digit, and now we're going to be suffering triple digit inflation for energy, food, et cetera. What, how well off or how comfortable are the Russian people compared to where we're heading here in Europe?
Well, let's start with, I guess, the good news. Things like that, like the my electricity bill and phone bill and all that stuff has not changed one bit. And of course, on by global standards, they're pittance. They're very small. You know, I have this package from the phone company where I have four telephones, unlimited minutes and internet and all that stuff for like $17 a month for four phones, the family package, right? The internet, I forget how much. The internet's part of that. Never mind. For at home. And when I'm in the woods, the internet there is, I don't know, $5 or $6 a month. And the electricity, God, I think, for the city is, well, the whole thing for the city, all of it combined, works out to be less than $100 a month. And for living out the sticks, it's like 50 or something. So again, wow, it's not very much. Okay. But remember, Russian salaries are not very great. So when you say things in dollars, it kind of leads to this assumption that Russian salaries would line up to a dollar salary, which they don't. But still, I would say that those things are very affordable in Russia. That's one thing you can do. The one thing that did get expensive in Russia more than anything was food, which is kind of surprising. It doesn't quite make sense. This is something where you might want to talk more to an economist about when Russia produces its own food overwhelmingly. Why did that get more expensive? But as a parent, I can tell you that's the real thing that's kicking my butt this year. Food got, I would say, 20 to 30% more expensive across the board. Yeah, and I'm kind of middle class here. And so I definitely think like the working class person, very, very, very hit hard on the food front. So,
okay. All right.
That's that I can say for sure. I've seen this meme going around that says like everything in England is getting more expensive and everything in Russia is getting cheaper. I've gotten some arguments with people. I just, they keep telling me that like food in Russia is getting cheaper. It's not. I'll put it this way, Jeff, if someone's curious, like when I look at the money I earn versus where the money goes, for the most part, the real big expense is our gullets. It's food. Food is the real expensive thing. Otherwise, stuff in Russia is not too bad expense wise. It really, really isn't. But food, it really adds up quickly.
Well, that being the case, I mean, are the citizens holding out with the special military operation? And I mean, are they fatigued or bored? Or I mean, are they in it for the long haul? Because it is going to be long. Oh, it looks like.
Well, there's fatigued that might make someone think that like if someone is fatigued with the political issue, that they're going to take to the streets and try to change it. I'm not talking about that fatigue. There's a little bit of fatigue again of like, everything in Russia is on hold. I mean, I just mentioned people planning their lives about the purchase of a car. Maybe again, I'm sort of, maybe it's my middle class, upper middle class way of looking at things. But I mean, literally, Jeff, everything is on hold. Like, you know, if you talk to anyone about any, I've tried to get a couple different projects started. Wait till it's over. Like that's the universal answer to everything. Wait till it's over. So yeah, there's that. But I would say, let's just say from the perspective of people who are of less resources than I do, let's just say less income. I'll put the kind of column of I don't quite know how they're doing it, but they're doing it. And the support for everything that's happening is overwhelmingly high. And in fact, in a lot of ways, even looks like the end, maybe not the end, sort of World War II. Because remember, for the Russians in World War II, it really gave the Soviet Union a lot of strength that everyone sort of had to fight the war together. be they Russian or Jewish or Chechen or the Tuvan or whatever, Tuvan now changed. And that's exactly what we're seeing now, because like everyone from across the Russian space is fighting in this war. It's very much, I would say, in a lot of ways, it's sort of reinvigorated and unified the country in a lot of ways. But again, you know, on it, we have these bigger ideological stuff happening, which is good. But on a day-to-day basis, you know, I definitely think that there are probably a lot of fathers out there who are, let's say, oh, gosh. I know guys who do like the construction. I think it's not a real happy time to be a construction worker with like four kids. You know, that's going to be work out being a lot of hot dogs and macaroni. Which you may not expect, but hot dogs and macaroni is sort of the typical hard times food for Russia.
So, Interesting. I know you have seen them, but are average Russians paying attention to what Putin and Lavrov, the foreign minister, and Medvedev, the former president, saying about the end of Western Empire? I mean, they have all been giving some incredible speeches, and just yesterday, you know, Putin was in Vladivostok for the Eastern Economic Forum. Again, a powerful, powerful speech about the downfall of Western Empire. Are Russians aware of all this?
Well, one thing that, although you may hear me criticize the Russian media very often, because it just certain things like movies and video games, it completely ignores. It just doesn't do them for the most part. It's very frustrating. This comes from someone who used to work in the Russian video game industry, which I should call the Russian buy, translate, and republish industry. But anyway, but the one thing the Russians do very well is news. And not just within their own, so not just within whatever's happening with what Putin says or Medvedev or Shoigu or so on and so forth, but anything that happens, especially in English speaking, and even beyond that, anything that happens of any interest or slight, tiny relevance to Russia that happens anywhere in the world, but especially if it's in English, immediately translated in somewhere on the Russian internet. Russians are very good with this process. So in some ways, I think in America, we have this perception of like whatever America thinks about Russia, or what American politicians do is a little bit mysterious, like as if the Iron Curtain was still up. Well, no, absolutely everything gets over here immediately and is translated immediately. Russians are very astute about that sort of thing and about the news. So would I say that the Russians tend to be a more informed society or less informed society? I would actually put them on the more informed side. Now, does that mean that every person you meet here is going to be some sort of like political genius who understands the zeitgeist of their time? No. It's like everywhere. You know, some people are you know, sometimes the simple masses with their simple desires and all this other stuff. But would I say that people are more... here's a difference between Russians and Americans. Russians are curious. That's a big difference. Russians are very curious about what's happening in other places and other things. And so there's maybe more of a thirst for knowledge. But again, I don't want to paint this picture like everyone here is some sort of intellectual. I mean, that doesn't exist in any country. That would be like, okay, let's not kid ourselves here. Now, the question is, does the average person understand the context of what the heck is going on in terms of this like multipolar world and all that stuff? Well, the political class sure does. Everyone that I know who writes about politics, so like the journalists, the pundits, the sort of ideologues, even famous economists, because economics and politics here mix a lot more. All those people that I know, they are very much aware of that. Okay. So if we were to take America, I don't know, it'd be like if you were to say, if every one of your friends who write some kind of blog, every one of your friends who works at a news station, every one of your friends who happens to be in political science in a university knows about something, that kind of group of people, yes, they're very much aware of it. But that's a small, you know, segment of the population.
As a subset of that, are average Russians following all the amazing evidence that they're Ministry of Defense is releasing on Western WMD bioweapon development in Ukraine. And James Bradley and I have done a number of reports on this, and it's just so incredibly shocking. Is this also in the, it actually made it on Turkish national TV. They actually reported it. But are the Russians informed about all the bioweapon, U.S. bioweapon labs in Ukraine and all the horrible things going on?
Oh, yeah, that's more universal. Everybody heard about that. That was a big, big thing here. And, of course, I would imagine, as you're someone who talks about China very often, I bet in China that is also almost universally known. Because, you know, it kind of has that... smell of almost like a plan of eugenics. So yeah, oh yeah, that everybody heard about that, and of course people are happy about it. But then again, what are truck drivers and plumbers and carpenters gonna do with that information other than be annoyed? I don't know. But yeah, that's that was spread universally, and that was definitely something where it was thankfully properly portrayed by the media. Because if you could see even on my channel, I was probably one of the first places anyone would have ever heard about this, from this whole Ukrainian biolab network, because I was tipped off by people. And you can go back and watch that big interview with me, but, on my channel, Tim Kirby Russia. But, yeah, so thankfully the news media here did a good job of actually taking that truthful information and, disseminating it. But one thing that you have to also understand is that there's this perception that in Russia that basically all TV is Putin TV 24 hours a day, and that all media is Putin media or whatever, you know, and that's also far from the truth. There's depending on where you live, there's like 20 some free TV channels, and the majority of which aren't informational. Okay. So about Putin TV, when you're getting into like home renovation programs or like, soap operas and stuff like that, this has nothing to do with Putin. Okay. So we get rid of that first layer. And then secondly, you know, a lot of people about the special operation, are looking to alternative sources. I mean, there are a lot of, Russian speakers, you know, who have their own, you know, YouTube or especially VK and Telegram, where there's less censorship, VK Telegram kind of channels going. That's where a lot of people are turning for information. So it's not just like Russians hear the official declarations of the Ministry of Defense, believe 100% of it, nod their heads and go with it. I would actually say that, to be honest, I think what the Ministry of Defense does is supplemental almost compared to what's going on in Telegram. I mean, if you open a Telegram and you have the ability to speak Russian, there's so much information about this war, because again, for Russia, this whole Ukrainian thing, like I said, for the last 8 years since the Maidan, has been issue number one in Russia, by far issue number one.
That's really interesting. That's really, really noteworthy. Well, speaking of Maidan and what's happened since then, I have been following the map of Russia's progress in Ukraine, and it just is so frustrating, Tim. I use the maps on South Front. I think they're probably as good as any, and it just seems like it's frozen. You know, the Ministry of Defense, you know, I mean, they put out all this information every day on Telegram, as you talked about, and there's even some really good Telegram channels in English too for those of us. But what about Odessa and Kharkiv? And I think most noteworthy is recently, I think it was maybe a month ago or 3 weeks ago, the Minister of Defense, Shoigu, he went to Donbass and last month and ordered expanding a protective zone big enough towards the west to keep Ukraine from bombing civilians indiscriminately in Donetsk. But I look at the map on South Front and there is just no change. What's going on?
Well, this is the thing where I think the truth will be probably revealed in memoirs at some point. But what's happening with it, in my personal opinion, is that in the first part, they had to fight this war carefully, because the hard part is you can't just go in there and just kill everyone. This isn't Iraq. This isn't us versus them. This is us versus an occupying force of us. And so the wars had to be fought very carefully. There's kind of an iconic meme that goes around the Russian internet where it shows a, basically a five-story apartment building. A lot of the buildings that were built in the old days were five stories tall. And you can see the top three, four floors are just black and riddled with holes, and the bottom two floors sort of aren't. And that's because there was some sort of plan for the Ukrainians to get on the top, or the Ukrainian forces to get on sort of the tops of all these buildings, right? And it kind of shows the kind of fighting they're doing. You know, the bottom two floors weren't hit. And that it's more of a much more of a precision operation. Furthermore, I think after we've seen the dollar sort of crash to the ruble, Russia making changes like tagging the ruble to gold, the Russian economy surviving this, and it seems like the West is suffering more. It just seems like Russia sort of had, the long game benefits Russia. So I think that they're just going to sit there, try to lose as few men as they can, and just grind this thing out. You know, there's no reason. Okay. There's no reason to rush into anything. And I think the two. Another thing about not rushing is the effects of winter on European politics this year are going to be very interesting. And so there's no necessity to lose so many young men when sadly, the real tragedy of this, Jeff, from my own perspective, as well, now I'm almost too old for the American draft. That's at 42. I'm still 40. But as someone who's technically draft age for the United States, I can't imagine what it's like to be drafted right now and be sent to the front lines, because essentially with the Ukrainian, if you're a young guy there, you have the, you sort of are facing, you can't escape the country, because unless you have money, you can't escape. So you can't run away. Or well, if you do, you better run away. You better do a good job. You better go through the forest at night and not get caught. So you can't escape. If they catch you, they're going to force you to fight. If you don't fight, you go to jail. But in all honesty, if you really don't fight, then the guys in the special battalions, the commissars, are going to kill you. So you're essentially sort of put to this death sentence. But then if you go forward, you're going to get slaughtered. Because if you look at the recent footage from the counteroffensive in Kherson, you could see Ukrainian terrain. It's like a World War I no man's land. It's almost completely open. And a lot of these guys are just dying for nothing. Because the Russian sort of answer would be, well, why don't you surrender? Well, you know what? When artillery shells are flying, and when the Russians are pounding, and there's a commissariat standing behind you that'll shoot you in the back, it's not so easy. I think a lot of these guys would like to surrender. They just sort of can't, and it's a real tragedy watching so many guys. It's, you know, there's no real footage of it, but I kind of feel like we're watching the French in 1914 walk out into a modern era battlefield, you know, with their beautiful blue trench coats and their lovely red pantaloons with the long rifles, just marching in glorious formation to be gunned down. That's what you're looking at right now. And it's a tragedy and unfolding in front of our eyes. But there's not much Russia can do about it, because the Kiev regime keeps putting those guys out there to die. And now women are up in the draft as of October 1st.
Oh my God! Plus, also, of course, NATO is depleting its arms stores to enrich Zelensky and all the other billionaires and crooks in Ukraine. I saw an article where at least 30% of the arms never even make it to the front lines. They're being sold off, and it's just a tragic situation. And I think it's kind of just, I think it's a real sort of sort of sweet justice. NATO thought that Russia was going to run out of missiles and arms in 2 weeks. And now it's NATO that's running out of arms and depleting their stores. So the war of attrition is now in Russia's favor. Okay, well, I'll be more patient with the map.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, I mean, I just to say there's good reasons why it is the way it is. But I'll put it this way. This isn't if someone wanted something glorious that would look good, to make, I don't know, a movie out of. Unfortunately, sit there, wait till they appear and just gun them down is not a very exciting movie. But, you know, that's the strategy that works, and that's what they're sticking with. So.
I will rest easier when I know that the Russians and the Donbassians have liberated Odessa and Kharkiv, because I think those are that would just basically sort of be the end of it at that point. All right, let's get a little bit, take a little bit look at China. Are average Russians, you know, are they comfortable with their country's close relationship with China? Do they fear the Chinese, respect and or admire them, like them or dislike them? And do they, and most importantly, do they realize how important their bilateral cooperation is in the current events?
Okay, so these are a few different things, and the answer to them are going to kind of bounce back and forth.
Okay.
Working in partnership with China, I would say it receives complete, you know, let's do it. Why not? Let's work with whoever wants to work with us. Whoever's willing to get along with us, this is great. Now, the problem is that because we've had in Russia 300 years of this pro-Western, Eurocentric way of looking at the world, I think that in Russia, to be honest, overall, despite the fact that Russians sort of pride themselves on being more worldly than maybe other civilizations, I think our Russian worldliness is very much so focused on things that have been in the Russian attention, and Chinese culture isn't one of them. I think that we have a long way to go in terms of trying to get to know China. I think that that would be something where, again, if I was some sort of more powerful person in Russia, which I'm just a commoner who happens to have a very inefficient media empire, you know, like I think that one thing would be to try to have more information or try to really get it so that way. Let me just put it this way. If we were to talk to the average Russian about, like, say, America or England or then China, about America and England, maybe their view of America and England won't be correct, but they have a lot more basic knowledge about, like, what the terrain is like, what the history is like, what the language is like, what places are there, what kind of businesses are from there, so on and so forth. Well, with China, of course, we all know Xiaomi. I hope that I'm saying that even close to correct. So we love them. But although there's a lot less, you know, people don't really know that much about Chinese history or Chinese geography or, you know, how I've watched a lot of things about China. So I know food in the north is a lot more probably appetizing to Russians than food in the Chinese south would be. All that kind of stuff. We don't really know. I can say, though, that they're starting to offer Chinese as a language in schools as an alternative to English. So that'll definitely help a bit. But yeah, I think we kind of need to get to know China. In terms of things that are negative, is there's been this myth or meme or psyop that they, for many, many years, they've tried to say that actually the eastern part of Russia is completely under Chinese control already. The Chinese just pour over the border, this, that, and the other. And if you yourself know, if you look at a map of China, although there are some very population-dense areas, there are a lot of space left in China itself before having to jump the border. And so I can tell you firsthand that there's I believe it's called Slavyanka, or is a tiny, tiny town very close to China, didn't see one Chinese person there. So there's sort of this myth that China is going to sort of absorb Russia due to its massive population and its proximity, this, that, and the other. So I don't know how many people actually believe in that, but it's something that is a feared belief that's online, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's kind of it. Like I said, I would say maybe then overall it's a lack of knowledge that's the problem, rather than the sort of incorrect or correct knowledge.
Well, that's good that they're going to be teaching Chinese in public schools, and I assume that China has some Confucius Institutes in Russia, and at least in some of the bigger cities.
I'd have to imagine. So I forget, what is that TV network? Their logo is, I believe, it's like a gold square, CGT?
Yeah, China Global Television Network. Okay. They're doing some good stuff.
Yeah, that is in Russia.
Good work.
So the Chinese and the Russians were able to work out where Russia Today is allowed in China and CGTN is allowed in Russia. So the thing is, though, I find a lot of Chinese material in foreign languages to be a bit on the dry side. I wish it kind of jazz it up a bit. But there have been sort of deals where there's some, like, I could tell you, it was on TV. It was like an action movie, but it was made in China, but they used some Russian actors to sort of cross promote it. And I think it had Peter the First in it, which is weird. But there's some sort of like with a cinema cooperation here. So some of this stuff, the necessary things I think are happening for Russia and China sort of get acquainted. But again, it's all going to take time. What I said about education, I can confirm because my children speak English as a native language. And so we sort of went and applied because they're supposed to get learn their native language at school and then plus one other language. And so they have Russian and English both as native, and the plus one language was offered as Chinese. And there's another school that's down the street that they don't go to. And they definitely said when we went, when my kids were littler and, you know, before they started, we sort of went to see if we wanted to go to that school. And yeah, they said that they teach Chinese. So yeah. So I listed two schools in this Moscow area that I can confirm 100%. Now, is this like a national program to learn Chinese? No, but foreign languages are a part of the national curriculum. And they don't have to be English, although English is definitely the dominant one. But yeah.
Well, that's great. I hope they learn Chinese. If you start out young, I always told my children, I said, if you could learn Chinese and Russian along with your English, you know, I mean, I think those, you know, would be three of the most important languages to learn. Yeah. And in the coming century. So we have a daughter who's fluent in Chinese, French, and English, and so it has really, really, really helped her career.
Oh, wow. She must get a little bit confused sometimes, because even knowing two languages now, I'm all messed up, man. All the time. Very confusing, but yeah.
What about Iran? Iran is so important. Iran and China just, you know, signed a 25-year comprehensive cooperation agreement. Iran is the most powerful military power in the Middle East. 80 million people, impenetrable with all their mountains and everything, and missiles and military. I know Iran is trying to, Iran and Russia have agreed, they're also going to sign a bilateral comprehensive cooperation agreement. Do the Russians like or dislike Iranians? Or, I mean, do they see a relationship there?
Well, let's go take a step back from China again. Well, what do we have in China? We have Shenzhen, Guangzhou, these sort of new cities that have popped up that all Russians know about. We have Xiaomi. We have Huawei. We have the Geely cars, the Great Wall cars as well. There's a lot of stuff that is coming from China, products, brands, and all this stuff, which are very superficial. I mean, you're not going to like be able to just touch a Geely car and automatically gain some sort of wisdom, right? But there's something, right? With Iran, I see it's kind of a blank slate. The way the media always portrays the Iranians that I tell people is that it's sort of like they're good business partners. The Iranians they're very reliable. They're good business partners. But we don't really see anything. The only thing I ever really see coming from Iran are stuff like watermelons and figs. You know, figs, those little weird, I don't even know what they are. They're good. If you remember those Fig Newton cookies, they're delicious. Mm-hmm. But from Iran, we really get very, very little information from them. And I do believe because their society is more on the sort of, you know, conservative side. This would be probably a good time if Iran does have some sort of more touristy zones, because for example, Egypt can be sometimes very conservative, but they sort of have an entire separate like resort tourist industry. Now would be a really good time, because in Iran it is really hot. and they have the sea and all that stuff. And Russians are looking for a place to go, but unfortunately there's just very little contact. But again, nothing negative. I would say again, from the Russian side, from the average person, zero problems. I guess what? No one here cares at the end of the Islamic Revolution. Do not care. That's the one nice thing, especially about Russia now, that we have to keep is don't care. In China, if they want to have some sort of like little bit of communism, little bit of Confucianism mix, that's their civilization. That's their deal. We got a big country here. We're fine. Go nuts. And that's the same thing with Iran and their revolution, their system. Hey, if that works for you, just don't bring it here. It's cool. We're good. Boom. So when you have this nice sort of more neutral political position or multipolar political position, it's hard to really be particularly, I don't know, riled up. Like you have to be this really like sort of snooty, like, I don't know, a Berkeley graduate Californian to just be like disgusted by every culture that doesn't do things exactly the way you want them to. And to an extent, I think the leadership of the Soviet Union did sort of act that way. There are definitely, we could say, some moments where they were very, you know, if you're not, you know, going to support communism, then you're a bad person sort of thing. And that's all gone. And now I think we sort of have this nice intellectual freedom, and it's the intellectual freedom to, because I was going to say have tolerance, but it's not even tolerate because you're not tolerating anything. We're not tolerating Iran having a different system. We don't care. That's their business. So it's easy to make friends when you're like that. But again, if there's not enough contact between Russia and China, like the contact between us and the Iranians is buying their figs and like watermelons. It's an absolute near zero. I mean, well, one thing I could say is the Ayatollah, you know, and all the other Iranian sort of leadership, they do have VK accounts. So, you know, you can read, you know, they're on the Russian social media networks. So maybe on some sort of smaller level, there's maybe a little bit more contact going on. But I would say Iran remains a mystery. Kind of like for, let's see, if we're Americans, it's like, I don't know, like Mozambique or I don't know, you know, like Malaysia. Malaysia never makes the news. It's big. There's a lot of people there. Never makes the news. So it's like that. It's just this sort of mystery that, okay, it exists, whatever.
Well, hopefully the comprehensive bilateral agreement, I think they're also talking about a 25-year agreement. And of course, for people who need to know about geography, Iran and Russia have a common border. So there's a lot of opportunity for trade and infrastructure.
Iran and Russia had a common border when it was the Soviet Union. Now there's the common Caspian Sea space.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Allows them to trade in between each other. But no, unfortunately, with the end of communism, that was the end of the border.
Okay, got it. What are we going to do about Syria? You know, when is Russia going to put its foot down on Israel and Syria? I mean, they're bombing international airports. They just put the Aleppo International Airport out of commission. Russia's there. If Russia wasn't there, it would have already been overtaken and turned into another Libya, like Hillary Clinton and Obama did to Libya and the French and the British. But what can Russia do in Syria to get a hold of this? Are they not able to?
Well, one thing we have to remember is that there's a definite policy shift, again, going to the Cold War. I think the Russians woke up and realized that they spent a lot of their wealth, maybe even most of it during the Cold War, you know, kind of fighting for communism in other countries rather than building a nice country for themselves. And that mistake has definitely been recognized, and that's why they told Assad that we're going to help you, but you guys are going to have to fight the war yourselves. So what's happening in Syria? Yes, absolutely. The Russian factor is critical because Syria could have never stood up against, you know, a full NATO assault and all that stuff. But it's their war to fight. And Russia's just there to sort of assist. It was to help in the initial phase. Russia's not going to So that's a little bit more of a question to the Syrian leadership. Maybe they're afraid to escalate. You know, maybe they think that if they really do seriously escalate against Israel, this is going to be the start of World War III in a hot way. I think, to be honest, we're actually in a soft World War III right now, but I was meaning a World War III with like pushing the button. Another thing is the part of Syria that the Israelis are occupying, again, is sort of on the edge of that Golan Heights region. And one thing that's also important to note about that is it's a mountainous region. And, you know, taking mountainous regions always require an incredible amount of manpower. They're incredibly difficult to take. Afghanistan is the key example. And perhaps there might be a little bit of a waiting game, because trying to take it back could just take way too many resources. And we can't forget that there's all sorts of crazy stuff still happening on the territory of Syria. And maybe it's just sort of like giant problem. It's like difficulty level of doing that, maximum risk level, maximum reward level. Well, we get back and control a lot of these sort of like mountains, which are still technically internationally acknowledged to be ours. Wait, I think it's just wait. Because remember, I don't know where the West is going. Unfortunately, it's not looking to be in a good direction. But who keeps Israel propped up? I mean, I've met a lot of people from Israel, and they are very industrious, definitely not lazy. So I think that to say that Israel only exists on because America feeds it is a bit of an exaggeration. But without money from the West, all of a sudden, I think Israel is going to find itself on kind of equal footing with its neighbors. But the problem is, all of its neighbors hate it, and there's a lot of them. You know what I mean? So I think Israel is going to have some tough times. If the West has tough times, Israel is going to be in a whole world of hurt, and something there is going to change. So I think it could be the waiting game.
Yeah, the United States basically just gives Israel several billion dollars a year and military hardware and, of course, intelligence and et cetera, not to mention protecting them at the United Nations and on every single vote. So, I just hate seeing what's going on there. And thank God Russia's there, because otherwise it would be, Assad would be sodomized by Western paid henchmen, like they did to Muammar Gaddafi, and it would be another hellhole like Libya. But thanks to the Russians, that's not happening.
No.
And what do you think about Turkey? Turkey is just a wild card. I mean, they just, Erdogan, it's like he wants to recreate the Ottoman Empire, and he wants the first 30 kilometers of northern Syria. Idlib, but then they try to help Russia with, get grain out of Ukraine to ship to Africa. What do you think about Turkey? I mean, that's just
okay. Tell people with Erdogan, it's simple. Erdogan is on Erdogan's side. He's doing what he thinks is best. And to be honest, God bless him that he wants to make Turkey great again. I understand that, man. I understand that the desire where he sort of wants to undo what Ataturk did in a lot of ways. And I get it, but he's going to face a lot of resistance. The problem is making Turkey great again requires essentially, if we look at what the Ottoman Empire looked like, it would require a lot of pushing into territory where he's not wanted. And I understand he's trying to wheel and deal. He's kind of trying to play sides off against each other, to build more relevance for Turkey, build more money and all that stuff. So I get what he's trying to do. He's definitely trying to put Turkey first, which is respectable, but I don't know. The proof will be in the pudding, but so far we're watching the lira crash. His drugs, they keep crashing. And so they're still problem is they're trying to sort of kind of play both sides, but they're still really completely economically integrated into this like fiat currency, Western world, neoliberal capitalism sort of universe. And I don't know really quite to what extent he's going to be able to do this, but is he making money? Is he just trying to do best for his population? He probably is. It's just a real tough time to be Turkey right now. It's a real, real tough location geopolitically, especially with the rise of Russia. If Russia were not to be a thing, And you look at Europe kind of falling apart. Maybe it would be the Turks' day, but Russia is always going to be the big is always going to be the big problem for them.
Mm-hmm. And for people, just as a reminder, Turkey's a member of NATO. You know,
yeah.
technically, Turkey's supposed to be fighting Russia, but they're not. They're ignoring the sanctions.
Well, yeah, and you can't remember that Turkey is one of the two countries that are the only ones that I know of. Perhaps I'm missing something. Maybe some astute viewers could correct me. But are the only sort of two NATO countries that have had an inter-NATO conflict on Cyprus.
This isn't a new thing.
Greece, this was before Erdogan. Yeah. So, Turkey is a little bit of a wild card. And I think in some ways the West or the United States during the Cold War was just so excited about having Turkey and being able to put like nuclear missiles really close to Moscow via Turkey. That's what got them excited. And I think to this day, Turkey is very much exploiting this, their usefulness from the Cold War that's gotten them into all these organizations and almost even gotten them into the EU. But I think that, again, Turkey's maybe benefited a lot by not being in the EU, because if they were, then they'd essentially be another Greece, a big Greece.
The EU is a disaster, but that's a whole nother show. Mm. Hey, Tim, this has been wonderful. One final question. I just recently saw a 2020 documentary on Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, who just died this last week. And it was in Russian and it was dubbed in French. So I watched it in French, but I was shocked where they said that he only had a 3% approval rating in Russia. I mean, I could imagine that with Yeltsin, but man, 3% for me, it seems like for Gorbachev is really low. Is the 3% accurate, and how did the average Russian respond to his death and funeral?
A 3% approval rating sounds pretty darn right to me. The day he died, in the morning when I wake up, I first thing I do is I turn my phone off airplane mode, and I get just a billion notifications. Some relevant, most not. But the Gorbachev is dead memes everywhere. It was a he is so despised across the country that it was like a joyous celebration for the masses. He's absolutely hated. And the thing I never really thought was when he did that Pizza Hut commercial, that was like the number one thing that people were talking about on the day he died. A lot of the memes related to that. Something about that the leader of the country did this like Pizza Hut commercial that really offended the population. And so, yeah, but yeah, Gorbachev is seen as a traitor. He is seen as we also have to remember that, by Russian, if we believe the Russian government's sort of internal calculations and how many people died, well, you know, World War II was about 27 million people, but the 90s killed about over 10 million people from various things, including starvation and violence and all this other stuff. So essentially, he basically led Russia into essentially World War level casualties to achieve nothing. He was the great Judas, and most people are just sort of now annoyed that he was never put in jail for it. So, but there's political reasons for that, and I understand it. So,
his house there in Moscow, where they filmed it, it was really beautiful. But if he's 3%, then Yeltsin must be 0.
Oh, I don't know. The one thing about Yeltsin is there's this weird phenomenon where because he was goofy and silly, some people have some weird fond memories of Yeltsin. I would say Yeltsin is probably it's definitely under 10%, but I think it would be higher because Gorbachev was really the one who made the change happen. Yeltsin, I think a lot of people don't really understand that Yeltsin did have a role in all this stuff. But I think a lot of the average people don't really know that. They just see him as just a complete idiot, just a complete failure as a person. But it's kind of like, oh, gosh, I don't know. Is there something maybe charming about Boris Johnson and his goofy hair and his drunkenness during COVID? See, you're laughing. See, there's something about that that's kind of, I don't know, a slight endearingness to this weird type of politician. The drunk loser politician. So I would say he'd get more, whereas Gorbachev was just Judas. He's just the traitor. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. He doesn't have this sort of like other side of something that maybe people liked. Because remember one of the things they said during the election of, I believe during one of the elections where it was George Bush was up there. Was it George Bush or who else? But one of the big questions was, well, a lot of Americans determine the president by the guy they'd want to sit down and have a beer with. That is very stupid. But I think that for a lot of the masses, when they have this emotional reaction to who their leader is going to be, I think actually very relevant. And so I think Yeltsin has more of that, like, well, he may be an awful, awful, horrible leader, but he is the kind of guy I would like to have a beer with. You know, I think it's a little bit of that maybe with him, but I don't know. But I do know the Yeltsin Center, when the apparently every president of Russia, when they die, are going to get a museum dedicated to them at some point. And the Yeltsin Center, which is in Yekaterinburg, where he is from, is if you want to talk about something that Russian patriots want to burn down, that is sort of a... that is something where I think one day when the political climate does change, I do think that Russians are going to torch it because it's been vandalized a bunch of time. It's sort of become this symbol of something because the museum really, it does really sort of rewrite history. I mean, it's sort of, again, this Yeltsin, this real failure of a leader in horrible times. They really did their best job to kind of like paint a positive picture of it. And I can tell you, because I've been there, that they I believe they say that there's eight most important days of his leadership. And they picked these sort of 8 days where something was very relevant happened to his leadership. And the thing is, I think two of them are like, one is like the day he died, and the one is the day he had heart surgery, because there's just nothing good. You know, they just tried to like stretch it, you know, like get to their homework. And they make the font really big. So two of the days were just he was sick and then he died. It was unbelievable. It was amazing. What an amazing leadership. So it should really be the 6 days of Yeltsin, where they had these six very relevant events and stuff like that. So yeah.
Well, if they in the documentary, it was actually really well done. I mean, I'm no fan of the guy, and I knew he was an abomination for what happened to Russia and Russians, but it was really well done. And one of the scenes is he goes to he has a Gorbachev center somewhere. He's got a Gorbachev.
Yeah, I think there is one. Yeah,
in Moscow. So I guess they'll torch that one too.
Oh yeah. Well, that one. Well, the thing is, the Yeltsin one's a lot more famous. So, but we'll see.
Yeah. Hey, listen, Tim Kirby, Russia. Everybody, go to YouTube and just type TIM space KIRBY space Russia RUSSIA, and subscribe to his channel like I do. Although, of course, YouTube, because they hate me and now I'm blocked and can't use YouTube anymore. I never get the subscriptions notices, but I am subscribed to Tim's channel, and I'm sure this will not be the last interview that we do together. Good. And it's just been a fun time. And I think the cross interviews with, you know, China, Russia, China. Please the fans out there on China Rock Radio Sunland, and I hope they please your fans too. So anyway, thank you very much. I will put all of these I'll put your links on the page. I don't have your Telegram page, your Telegram channel, so please send me your Telegram channel
and I'll any do it other right now.
And any other social media that you'd like to share with the fans out there. All right.
Talk to you later.
Listen, I'll give you a nice Buddhist bow from China, and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.